Hi, and welcome to February and another month of episodes with Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. A few reminders, of course. Don't forget to get your copy of The Tudors by Numbers, which you can now order right from my website, carolandlloyd.com. I'd be very happy to sign and dedicate that book to you or the history lover in your life. And coming soon, I'm going to be having a cover reveal and some pre-publication news about my upcoming book, Courting the Virgin Queen. I also want to remind you, as it's February, and that's the month of Valentine's Day here in the U.S., we will be launching our first Royals and Rebels and Romantics ebook, and our first theme will be the top 10 lovers among the Royals, the Rebels, and the Romantics. So think about who you might choose among those top 10, and my patrons get to vote on the number one lover. So lots of exciting things happening this month, and I'm even more delighted to let you know we have another wonderful episode coming up right now. Welcome, everyone. I am so excited today to be here with Danielle Burton, who is the author of this great book that's not quite out yet. You can see on my version, yes, on my Kindle, I could get a copy, but it, yeah. When it says when it will be delivered. But we are going to be talking about this, and I want to introduce you to Danielle. So welcome to Royals, Rebels, and Romantics.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Well, I think this is going to be really fun because your research in this book is about someone that we sort of see, but we don't always give a lot of thought to. So I can't wait. But I want to start with a little bit more general question, which is, how did you get interested in history in general, but then in this period of history, the Wars of the Roses and the Plantagenets and all of that? So what was your journey to this point?
So really, I've inherited it from my parents. So we live about an hour away from Bosworth Battlefield. So obviously, it was lots of trips to go and see a lot of their reenactments that they have on and things like that. That's really, you know, as a kid, it's really quite exciting seeing all the people all, you know, pretty much living in the medieval period as much as you can do in this day and age anyway. So it's a bit of that. We joined the Richard III Society when I was 9. So it kind of, that this time period has always been in my life, really. It's kind of grown from a sort of knowing about Richard III the most to, you know, as you obviously from being 9 to, you know, 20 years later, you end up adding bits, don't you, really? So that's where it started. But I studied history at the University of Derby, which is my local university. And that's kind of where my other periods of history that I quite enjoy came in, really.
Well, that's great. So your family must be thrilled that you've taken that childhood interest and, you know, sort of turned it into your first book. So that's very exciting. So, all right, let's talk a little bit about how, so you've got the Richard III Society, so you joined as a family, is that right?
Yes, all three of us have been members for 20 years now, so yeah, okay. And try and get others involved as much as possible.
Okay, so that's a broad, I mean, Richard's reign and all the people in it, so what brought you from that to Anthony Woodville? How did you kind of decide where you wanted to research and sort of pursue that interest?
Yeah, so obviously knowing about Richard III's reign, I kind of knew about Anthony through his execution, which was right at the beginning of Richard III's tenure, really. So that's kind of where I knew of him. It was in that context to start off with, was him being executed at Pontefract Castle. And then actually whilst I was at university, I know that we'd been and visited there when I was quite a lot younger, but I said, can we go back? You know, I was, you know, I've had to, we do a lot of family history related trips. So I was like, can we go back? And they were like, yeah, okay, we'll go and do that. So we did. And I noticed actually that a lot of their interpretation is very much built around the fact that Richard II died there. Which is great, and that's also a really important period of history as well. But I just thought, well, where's, you know, for the Ricardians and, you know, the Wars of the Roses period, Pontefract Castle is quite a substantial building in that time period. So I can remember asking some of the people that worked there, did they know much about, you know, Anthony Woodville's execution and everything there? I've never seen anybody look at me more blankly and went, who was that? And I was like, the place where he died, that didn't feel right to me. So that's where my journey started in terms of, I thought, well, how can you not know who this person is? Because as you said, we all know kind of know the name, particularly as he's a Woodville. We know the name, but we don't necessarily know details about him. So that's kind of what started me on this journey, actually, because I just thought, well, why don't they know who he is? And that's what started the research, really. And I found a very interesting man that was more than how he died.
Oh, that is really interesting to identify this place so associated with him, but people don't really, you know, that should be part of the story. We understand the other part, but that certainly should be part of the story. Okay, so can you just sort of give us a history of who he was in the Woodville family, and just kind of give us a picture, and then we'll start going specifically into him. But who are the Woodvilles? How did he and the rest of the family sort of come into the forefront of the Wars of the Roses story?
Yeah, so we kind of know the Woodvilles mainly through Anthony's sister, Elizabeth Woodville, who went on to be the queen, the wife of Edward IV, and all the issues that their marriage ended up creating, really, as obviously we pretty much view them as kind of a peasant family, that Edward saw Elizabeth on the roadside and, oh, that was it, let's get married. Because we don't want other things happening. But really, they're actually a lower gentry family, is probably what we'd understand them as. So Anthony and Elizabeth's parents, Richard and Jacquetta Woodville, that's kind of really where you kind of start to understand what the Woodville family is, really. So Jacquetta was actually Jacquetta of Luxembourg, and she was the widow of the Duke of Bedford. So quite a very high, you know, European princess status, really. And after Bedford died, she fell in love with Richard Woodville, who has actually been part of Bedford's household, which kind of foreshadows the Elizabeth's later controversial marriage, actually. So it runs in the family, really. So because of that, they probably have more status if you look at Jacquetta's connections, really. But Richard Woodville was a squire, basically, when they got married, and obviously had to promote him once he married Jacquetta. So really, they are lower gentry family, but they are quite a substantial family in Northamptonshire, where their majority of their lands are based, really. So they're not quite as common as muck as what I think some people might imagine they might be. But they're not obviously the status that Edward IV should have been marrying into either.
Okay, so now Edward IV has been fighting for the throne and has taken the throne from the Lancastrians. So as we're in this kind of battle of the Wars of the Roses, let's just set out before the Edward-Elizabeth meeting, what side are the Woodvilles on? Because I do think that is important as the story unfolds.
Yes, it is. So obviously, if people know of this marriage, you instantly expect them to have been Yorkist. and actually, because of their connections with the Duke of Bedford, who was Lancastrian, that's where they started out at the beginning of the war, really. It was only when the Battle of Taunton happens and Edward wins this massive victory that they kind of concede, really, and they go, I think we've lost a lot here, so I think we better see how we deal with Edward on the Yorkist side. But actually, you know, once they turn Yorkist, they are Yorkist till the end.
Right. And I just think that's really interesting because we see people a little bit changing sides. And the whole country really sort of has to change sides because Henry VI is king, and then there are these battles, and then Edward's king, and then there are more battles, and then Henry VI comes back. And so it's this time of chaos and changing sides. And I think that is a really interesting part of the whole story, this kind of chaos, and it's really hard to get power. But it's also so hard to hold on to power and position and all of that. Okay, so Elizabeth Woodville marries Edward. It was not an appropriate marriage, as you mentioned, and runs in the family. That's quite interesting because hers kind of goes the other way. In Jaquetta's case, the woman really had the grand background and she sort of married down. In Elizabeth's case, I mean, there's no one higher than the king, so she really marries up. So how does that affect Antony in particular and the rest of the family when this marriage happens?
Well, of course, you can't deny that they benefited from that. There's no denying that, really. But actually, we kind of, that's the beginnings of where you start to see that idea of the Woodvilles being a grasping family comes from. Because actually, weirdly enough, when Richard and Jaquetta got married, there wasn't actually much comment on the fact that Jaquetta had married quite a lot, you know, beneath her. But obviously, as soon as Elizabeth marries Edward, it's the talk of everything. So actually, yes, of course, they did benefit from it. And there are various titles and roles given out that they probably would never have reached that level, you know, without marrying, you know, Elizabeth marrying Edward. But I kind of feel with Antony, he's not really given lots of titles and roles until actually, until the heir comes along when the future Edward V and Edward Prince of Wales becomes born, and Antony becomes the governor of him, so the person in charge of everything to do with the Prince of Wales after 1473. So actually, for Antony, it probably comes a lot later, really. I think in a way it's almost, compared to some of the other ones, that he's ended up having to prove himself a little bit more, really. But I mean, he did, there are examples of him doing that, but he didn't necessarily benefit power wise until much later.
Right. So I wanted to mention that so that we can look at some of the things. As you say, almost seems like he's proving himself, but he really has these extraordinary experiences on his own before he's sort of looped in to the royal household, as it were. So can you talk about, I'm really intrigued by his relationship with William Caxton. I think that is really interesting. So talk to us about that.
Yes. So actually, he does have some involvement with the royal household, obviously, being the brother-in-law to the king. But really, it kind of, William Caxton's quite complicated because there is two instances that there is a possible that Antony and Caxton first became involved with each other, and nobody's really sure which example it is. So it's either when Edward's youngest sister, Margaret of York, goes and marries the future Duke of Burgundy, Charles the Bold, because Antony is actually the head of the marriage party and he's also been part of the marriage negotiations as well. So it's possibly when he went to Burgundy escorting Margaret, and it's actually at that point when that marriage with Charles the Bold happens, that William Caxton, he was actually originally a merchant before he became the famous printer, you know, that he became later on. So at that point, he's actually the head of the merchant community out in Bruges. So obviously, marriage procession, everybody, if it was anybody in Bruges, would have been involved in this marriage procession. So it's a possibility that they'd have either met at that point or later on, like you've alluded to before, when Edward briefly has to go into exile when Henry VI is briefly restored. So Antony, as well as people like the future Richard III, and all, you know, this inner circle of Edward, all have to go into exile, and they do end up actually in Burgundy. And that's the other possibility of how we started to meet Caxton, because they're actually hiding with a guy called Louis, Lord of Cruthers, who was one of the major landowners in Bruges and was kind of, you know, a magnate, you know, the kind of person who was representative of the Duke. And they went and stayed with him in Bruges. And he's actually known to possibly have had the largest library in the whole of Europe. And actually, Margaret herself had started to patronise Caxton in the early parts of his printing career. So you can kind of see it's one or other of these that are entirely possible. But if not, it's definitely possibly, certainly a lot more likely that it's whilst out in exile, really, because that's when Caxton's already started to do his printing, and that they're kind of really immersed in, like I said, this cult book culture that starts to evolve. Because we kind of have an image of, you go straight from illuminated manuscripts straight to the printing press, when actually the both of them coincided quite well in this, you know, in the very early stages of the printing press, that you probably would still have presentation copies in which the first one that Anthony Woodville actually translated and William Caxton printed for him, it's called The Dixon Sayings of the Philosophers, which is kind of a lot of moral sayings and things from ancient Roman and Greek philosophers. That's actually the only image that we have contemporary of Anthony Woodville is from the illuminated manuscript version of that, in which he presents the copy to Edward IV. So I think there's quite a few interesting things to glean from that.
Right. And one of them that you just mentioned is that he is with Edward IV and Richard, who becomes Richard III, that they are part of that group that has to flee when Henry VI comes into power. So he is part of that inner circle that's, you know, following Edward as he rebuilds and then comes to take the throne back. And so the idea is you really had to be an efficient knight and fighter and warrior to survive. If you were going to be at that level of government where you're with someone who is claiming to be the king and there is someone else claiming to be the king, you better be prepared to fight. So what do we know? And I know it comes up later when he's with the young prince, but what do we know about Antony and his, you know, tournaments or his skill as a warrior, as someone who could defend the king and fight for the cause?
Okay, so actually, we don't see Antony himself at a lot of the major battles of the Wars of the Roses, actually, because he's usually busy looking after something else. like I say, he was definitely at Towton. That was the first instance that we know he definitely was at, as he was actually mistakenly thought to have been among the dead, but luckily he wasn't, thank goodness. Which is understandable with the amount of deaths that they were, because obviously Towton was the bloodiest battle to have been fought on English soil. So it's kind of understandable that people might have been misidentified, etc., etc. So that's the first instance that we have of his kind of military skills coming to the fore, really. So like I said, he wasn't actually at a lot of the prominent battles that we imagine to do with the Wars of the Roses, but actually not long after, a year after Towton, he's asked to go and help fight in Northumberland. So after Towton, the Lancastrians are moved north, and obviously Northumberland is along the border of the Scottish border, who quite often ended up helping the Lancastrian cause, really. So Antony is asked to go and help with the besieging of the castles there, and that's kind of seen as his first instance of kind of proving himself for the Yorkist cause, really. It goes disastrously wrong, nothing to do with Antony. They decide to do it in the middle of winter and they all freeze everything off, to be honest. That's why it didn't work very well. So there are glimmers of that in the early stages, really. And then the other one that we know he definitely fought at was actually the Battle of Barnet, which is the famous battle in the fog that the Earl of Warwick, the Wardville's actually main rival, was killed at. So he was actually injured in that battle, along with Richard, Duke of Gloucester, as well. So there are actual instances that we know that he definitely fought. But like I said, compared to somebody like probably Richard, Richard was at quite a lot of the major battles. So actually, Anthony's skills were more prominent on the jousting tournament scene, really. It's all very knight's tale stuff, to be honest. Really, really is. So actually, tournaments are actually quite a family thing. So we know that Richard Woodville, Anthony's father, definitely did jousting, and so did Anthony's brothers, John and Edward. They actually all of them were quite renowned for their jousting prowess, really, and they're all kind of tournament champions. But Anthony seems to have been the one that most people remember, because he had quite flamboyant tournaments, basically. Like I said, it really is a knight's tale stuff. So the most famous one that he fought was actually the tournament at Smithfield, which was actually fought against Antoine the Bastard of Burgundy, who was Charles the Bold's legitimate brother. So that was kind of fought in the around those circumstances of Margaret of York's marriage. It's all kind of diplomacy around that, really. So it's military style used, but also diplomacy. But it didn't quite go to plan, to be honest. So what happened was, like I said, it's all meant to be diplomatic. They're all meant to be fighting each other, but not to kill. And then it so happened that the Bastard of Burgundy actually accused Anthony of cheating because something had happened. And then Anthony was like, whoa, 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 no, I didn't. Nothing happened here. We can't tell 100% yes or no, it did happen. But from what I've noticed, actually, the Bastard of Burgundy was the victim of cheating from other people. So I think he had a little bit of a hang up, really. So obviously it was kind of said, right, we'll get rid of the horseback, because these tournaments were not just about horseback and lance skills that, like, we kind of imagine. They'd have used all sorts of different weapons, so you'd have that as well as your hand-to-hand combat with various swords and axes and other weapons, etc. And that's actually what happened. They said, right, okay, we'll stop the horseback, we'll be back tomorrow and do all of the hand-to-hand. And then it got very heated, as you can imagine, with all of these accusations flying. And Edward had to get the heralds to intervene, so people didn't get, neither of them got, too hurt, basically. But that particular tournament got cut short as the Duke of Burgundy actually died at that point. And then Charles did actually, the Bold did become the Duke of Burgundy at that point. So yes, he had to get cut short thanks to that. But he's got all of these skills, really, and I think a bit of flamboyancy mixed in right. as well. But
And that's really fun to think about, because, as you say, we often think of these tournaments being what is recreated at Renaissance fairs, which is horses and lances and spearing a ring or something like that. But they were ways initially of showing off some of the real military skills. And you can imagine that they could get heated, even if they were supposed to be all diplomatic, words get thrown, whatever. But he does sort of stand out in that. So we have him fighting alongside the king and Richard, Duke of Gloucester, in a couple of situations. And then we have him in these tournaments. So we have this sort of military side of him, or these skills, but it's a very religious time as well. So what do we know about his religious feelings or actions? I guess we don't really know feelings, but what about his religious actions? What do we see there?
So actually we see that he was a pilgrim for quite in a few different circumstances. So we know that he definitely went to quite a few pilgrimages in England, particularly Walsingham was quite a popular one. And we know that he again visited there with Edward and Richard as well. So that's a documented one. We know that he probably would have gone to Canterbury as well, as that's one of the other, you know, quite important pilgrimages to make in England. But we also know that he did you think, how on earth would they have managed it logistically in their day? Because obviously, you know, most pilgrimages would have been, like I said, conducted in whatever country anybody was living in. But just because transport and things like that were nowhere near as sophisticated as what they are now, and certainly roads are pretty much no more than dirt tracks, really. So and so actually you kind of get a sense of, well, pilgrimages would have been for anybody from, if you were actually given permission as, you know, a peasant working on you know, for the lord of the manor, if the lord of the manor gave you permission, you could go. So it would have been you know, like I said, if it was one in the same countries somebody lived in, it could be anybody of any class could have gone, as long as, you know, they were able to. But Anthony, like I said, he actually took part in some abroad. So we know he definitely went to Santiago de Compostela, which is where St. James is in Spain. So actually, like I said, think of that logistically. In their time, that would have only really been possible for somebody possibly like Anthony, who would have been, you know, nobility, would have been able to afford travel. Probably would have at least probably had some servant at least to go with him. So, you know, they're quite strenuous journeys. You know, it's not like us now where you can literally just pop on a plane, you know, it's nowhere near that easy. So he'd have actually had to travel through a lot of different pilgrimage sites in France before he got, you know, on his way to Spain. But that one in particular is actually quite poignant, because we think he undertook that particular one in memory of his mother Jacquetta, who had died the year before. But actually his first wife Elizabeth Scales died back in England during the time when he was on the pilgrimage to Santiago, which he obviously I assume, we don't know whether he'd have known that while he was on pilgrimage, whether that would have been an information he'd only know when he got back. I don't, you know, we don't know. But actually that one is also poignant in terms of his journey with Caxton, actually, as whilst on this journey, he befriended or talked to at least a Frenchman on his way. And he gave him a text in French that actually was the French version of the Dixensing and of the philosophers that he later translated. So actually, that's quite an important pilgrimage in terms of what he would do later on as well. And I think there's that exchange of knowledge in terms of they'd have been meeting all sorts of people on the way of the, you know, on during their journeys for these pilgrimages. So that one's quite important. And we do know that he also made pilgrimage to Rome as well, which again, logistically, it's quite difficult to do. And but we do know that for that one in particular, that Edward gave him like letters of passage so that people would know who he was, and, you know, he wouldn't get anybody hassling him along the way. So a bit like a passport, really. But he didn't get hassled. He actually got robbed on the way, because he'd have taken, which as it explains, with this one, that he'd have taken a lot of plate and things to give as offerings along the way. So yes, he had a lot of silver plate and things stolen from him, and there was a lot of letters trying to track down where all of his stuff had gone, because actually he wasn't that far away from Rome. So he was nearly there and he got robbed, but they actually managed to track his stuff down to Venice. So yes, so quite eventful journeys there. But Anthony himself had quite a personal affiliation with the Virgin Mary as well. So we know that he actually was a patron of a chapel called the Lady of Pew in Westminster, which was actually it was a chapel dedicated to the Virgin Mary, but it actually had suffered a fire, and it was in within the precincts of the Abbey and the Palace of Westminster. So it had suffered a fire, but actually they rebuilt thanks to Antony's patronage.
Well, you could see, and I love these stories because they demonstrate a very active faith. So he's going, and those, I'm so glad you mentioned the journey to the pilgrimage, the time he would spend getting there, and how difficult and dangerous, even with that passage, he still got robbed.
Yeah.
You know, it could be very difficult, very dangerous. He's going out of the country, so he's going on some fairly deeply costly journeys as a pilgrim. You know, he's making these pilgrimages, which do show a devotion or these faithful actions that he's undertaking. And it's also interesting, the ones in England, where you mentioned he's going with the king or he's going with Richard of Gloucester, he is again being seen as part of that family. Whatever happens later, he is part of that family in those times. And I think because the story is so dramatic, sometimes we skip over the part of the family stuff, which you're sharing with us.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's really interesting to see him with the family doing these difficult, doing a pilgrimage, you know, fighting alongside, participating in these tournaments, that he was really an integrated and active part of the family. So he is eventually appointed as the governor of the Prince of Wales. So what does that mean exactly?
So basically, initially when it's, you know, because really they haven't, Edward's got to kind of think, right, okay, now we have an heir, because if they'd waited a good 10 years or so, roughly, to have a boy, him, Elizabeth and Edward. So he's got to find his, you know, what do we do? he's not necessarily, because obviously he was the son of a duke before he became king. So he's like, okay, what do we do here? You know, it's not something that he'd have necessarily, you know, he wasn't brought up to be king.
Right.
So he's like, how do we grow a king, basically? That's his question. So initially you do kind of have a council around him that obviously involves Elizabeth, Vaudeville, Richard, Duke of Gloucester, all that sort of thing, and then Antony as well, trying to figure out what do we do, you know? And eventually what is decided is that, you know, the council was reduced. There was still some form of council, and, you know, it was also a lot of people from the Edward's household, people that would be trusted to kind of know what are the next steps, really, if Edward, you know, this Prince of Wales is going to become the future Edward V. You know, you just had a case of, you know, civil war for quite a long time. You know, we need to future-proof our dynasty, really, is what. That's kind of what everybody's thinking, really. So what happens is that it's decided that they should set up a separate household for him, and it ends up being in Ludlow, which is in the Welsh Marches. And I assume that's kind of, not only is that because Ludlow itself and a lot of the Welsh Marches were once the responsibility of the Mortimers, who were ancestors of Edward. But it's also kind of, it's possibly seen as two different things, really, a mixture of a safe haven in terms of, you know, if there's any more problems, you know, around London or elsewhere, it's kind of a bit out of the way. So there's the safety aspect, and also, like I said, the continuation of familial ties there. But it's also a case of, but it's a place to show power. Because the Council of the Marches was also part of this. So you're also saying, right, okay, we're going to have a seat of power that's centred around this Prince of Wales, really. So there's quite a few different things going off there. You know, after a few good few years of that, Anthony's placed as governor of the household, which basically means he's the one in charge of everything to do with Prince of Wales. So Edward IV actually writes a list of things that must happen, you know, how the prince must be looked after, what his education's going to be like. And really, I think from that, it shows that he's like, I don't want him to end up like me, that, you know, overeating, womanizing, probably a bit not that bothered about religion. We need somebody who's going to be a good, multifaceted person, you know, because obviously, like I said, Edward IV was, you know, his education would have been the son of a duke, not necessarily king, as he ended up being later on. So he's got to have, you know, the next level education. And obviously, really, it kind of shows how multifaceted the education would have been. So it would have been things like sport, probably dancing, as well as obviously your, you know, you need your military skills in that as well. And obviously your book learning. And Anthony, he's very good at doing quite a lot of those things. So I kind of feel like, yes, of course, he's probably got this job as being the brother-in-law of Edward IV, you know, the uncle to this young prince. But I kind of feel very much that he's gone, well, who kind of ticks those boxes to make sure those things are going to happen, you know, and who's, you know, who's responsible enough? Because, you know, it's a very big responsibility to make sure that, you know, this young prince is staying safe whilst also, you know, ticking off his education, really. So that's where Anthony comes in. And I think, you know, like I said, he's the best person, really, that fits all of those things at once. Because really, we think, if you kind of look at it in its basicness, then it's a very Renaissance, much later style education that you might possibly think. So actually, really, I think you can say it probably would have been a very early Renaissance type education, which I don't think you necessarily understand, because you kind of feel like, to us, you kind of say, when you say Renaissance education, you almost imagine Henry VIII being the first Renaissance, you know, prince, really. But actually, maybe there's a bit of that coming in already at this point.
Yes, because they had, after all these wars and turnovers and battles, things had settled down a bit. The second time Edward takes the throne, things yes. had settled down. And so now's the time to prepare for the future. As you say, let's get the dynasty strong and prepare for the future. And that was a huge responsibility for Anthony Woodville. And I think you're right. I think the idea of the combination of the military and the religious, and, you know, this interest in Caxton and translation and some of that, it's not yet a fully humanist education, but there are elements that are coming yeah. in of the scholarship and the valuing of that scholarship. So it was a really great opportunity for Anthony Woodville, but he was really prepared. And as far as my research, and you've researched this more, I didn't see anybody objecting to him or saying, no, he's not prepared for this. Everybody seemed to be, oh yeah, that's the right person to raise up, because, you know, this is a way yeah. from court. He's not being really brought up by his father. So Edward, young Edward, is being sort of raised up by Anthony Woodville. Okay. So that's going on. Things are happening in London. Edward V, unfortunately, is overeating and overindulging in all kinds of things. So we get to the point of the story where Edward IV dies, and then everything starts to change. And that's, you know, it was an unexpected death. He wasn't in great health, but certainly he was so young and, you know, he'd been so successful in battle. I think his death came to a lot of people as a surprise. But he did yeah. realize at least a few days before. So he set up a will that said what should happen, because his son, the prince, was only 12.
Yeah.
So tell us what happens then. Because now we've really met Anthony and we know what he's been doing and why he was chosen and given this incredibly important position. So what happens when the king dies?
So as you can imagine, everything just went out the window, as you can imagine, you know, because it's not that long ago that you've got the tumultuous reign of Henry VI, who actually came to the throne as a child and then ended up with possibly a lot of mental health difficulties that meant that Edward was able to become king. And then obviously not long before that, well, within about 100 years of or so, probably a bit less than that of this, you've got Richard II coming to the throne as well as a young child. And as you might imagine, neither of those instances ended very happily.
It don't end well, yeah. This is not a good precedent.
No, so I can imagine that it would have been a time of fear and uncertainty when it was hoped that perhaps, you know, the Wars of the Roses had kind of at least died down by this point. We don't want to go back to years and years of war because, you know, and obviously the other problem is that if you do have a boy king, there's instances for people to abuse that, which is particularly what started off a lot of the issues with Henry VI, definitely, that's kind of fueled a lot of the beginning of the Wars of the Roses was accusations of false ministers behind Henry VI. So I think there'll be a lot of fear that, you know, the stability that everybody, their country had craved is now at risk again. So I can understand that there would have been a lot of what do we do for the best in, you know, in what must have been a very awkward, difficult situation. But as you say, we believe that Edward had said that Richard, who was Duke of Gloucester, was obviously the boy king's paternal uncle, could be Lord Protector. But from my research, I've seen that actually there was actually quite a lot of discussion of what's going to be best in this situation. Would it be best to rule with one person in charge, or would it be better to rule with some form of council? You know, which option is going to be best? I mean, really, I can understand, obviously, it's probably going to be one of those two options anyway. So obviously there's discussion as to what would be best, although we believe that that's what Edward had asked for, that it would be Richard as Lord Protector. But actually, you know, it didn't entirely at that point rule out a possibility of a council, maybe, which I suppose would be understandable, really, considering the situation and that, you know, really. But I kind of feel like if there actually had been that as an option, as a council, I think really Anthony proved himself he would probably be a good person to have on that council, because that's pretty much what he'd already been doing with the Prince of Wales, and as he was the person who would have been most in Edward's life, really, because he didn't really have much contact with the rest of his family other than for holidays and you know, things, really, because effectively he was in a full boarding school, really, I suppose, is what we'd understand in our understanding anyway. So I think he would have been a good person to have on board for a council, because he'd already got this relationship with the boy king. And also, like I said, he's proved himself in multifacets of things anyway. So that could have been a possibility. But the issue was that it took quite a while for news to reach Ludlow that Edward IV had died. And this is when things start to get a little bit what did and didn't happen, really, as they also, it took them quite a while to actually leave Ludlow, because obviously they had to then move towards London, ready for proclaiming, you know, after he's been proclaimed king, to, you know, to the coronation. So they actually took a while to leave, and they didn't leave until after this. So we think that there's a possibility that they stayed in Ludlow to celebrate St. George's Day. So obviously, again, you know, that, you know, patron saint of England, of course, it's a very, very important saint day. So that's entirely a possibility. But there's actually quite open discussion about the fact that obviously you need some form of armed guard for this young king to transport him to London. And there actually is discussion as to how, you know, what number of armed men they're going to take with them. And I think the kind of agreement is that it's possibly that they, you know, compromise on 2,000 men, which is quite a lot, but obviously, understandably, you need a large armed guard. But I kind of feel like, well, if that's the compromise that was reached, still at that point wasn't even too much going off that could be bad at that point, if there's that the compromise that's been made. So it does sound as if there is... Because you also have this other problem is in terms of Richard Duke of Gloucester. He's basically the Lord of the North, as it were. So he's in his northern lands. So he's also got to be like, okay, right, okay, now I need to get to London as well. And, you know, all of this going off. So there is an agreement that they should meet on the road at that point. But actually, I don't... There is, again, a case of where should they meet and everything. And they agree on Northampton. And so the legend goes, it was moved from Northampton and they, the Ludlow household ended up moving to Stony Stratford, which is actually quite a small place outside of Northampton. And the excuse is that's supposedly given for that is that there's not enough room at the inn in Northampton, which is quite a large town because it's quite well known for shoemaking and things like that. So it's quite a, you know, as much as industrial as you can get in medieval times. So, you know, they'd have had places to stay, but that's the excuse that's apparently given as to why a lot of the household end up moving with the king to Stony Stratford. But actually, Annette Carson has actually put forward quite an interesting proposal, which I think is quite, I think it makes sense. But actually, like I said, the Woodfills, Northamptonshire is their heartlands, and their main house of Grafton isn't that far from Northampton and Stony Stratford. So is it a case of that's actually where they put up the king, and that would have been seen as a bit of a flashpoint, as, you know, keeping the king in, you know, in Woodville, Woodville security in that way. Although, suppose on from the other side, you could also say, well, actually, that's a way of keeping him safe as well. So, yes, a bit of issues or not issues there, depending on which viewpoint that you have, really. And actually, even at that point, Anthony, it's argued a little bit as to whether Richard Grey, who was Elizabeth's second oldest son from her first marriage, he was also involved with the Ludlow household. So it's argued whether Anthony and Richard were together and they stayed at Northampton, or whether it was just Anthony on his own to meet up with Richard Duke of Gloucester as arranged. And they actually, whether it was Anthony alone or Anthony and Richard Grey, they met with the Duke of Gloucester perfectly okay. They met as friends, as we said before. They were together in Edward's circle, and I wouldn't say friends necessarily per se, because there's no evidence of that, but certainly not cloak and dagger with each other, definitely not. And only a month before all of this, there was actually, the hope of some legal wranglings with each other, so, you know, help with legal issues. So actually, there was not necessarily an immediate sign that there was anything wrong, really. So they sat at dinner together and everything, and then it was only the next morning that things had changed and arrests were made. And all of these men that had suddenly been, you know, around the king were suddenly dismissed. So there's the whole idea is that it was possibly it was argued that they were involved in a Woodville plot to take over, and that was the reasons for these arrests. But as far as I've seen, if there's not really an evidence of, if there was one, because they said that there was weapons found with the Woodville coat of arms on, from what I've noticed, really, Anthony was out of the way in Ludlow and not really, you know, minding himself a little bit. So I kind of feel like if there was a Woodville plot, he either wasn't involved or they didn't tell him enough, really. So I kind of feel like he was actually quite scapegoated, really, if there was one. But I also find it very intriguing that the Duke of Buckingham, who had actually been excluded from power under Edward IV, who managed to ingratiate himself with Richard, Duke of Gloucester. It all changed, all of the atmosphere after the Duke of Buckingham arrived, and he was not a fan of the Woodvilles. So that was a possibility. There's a little bit of whisperings going on as well. Yeah. So which kind of, it's, you know, if that is the case, what a new opportunity to start doing that in terms of a new regime change.
Right. That's the time to move in, right? Because it's not yet established. And you're right. So we have this young king, which automatically that makes him vulnerable and potentially makes the nation vulnerable. Yeah. And so there needs to be this shoring up of support and bringing together. But in fact, at this, you know, whatever happened between dinner and the next day, something changed. So
yeah,
Anthony and Elizabeth's son were both arrested, correct?
Yes, along with Thomas Vaughan, who was actually the chamberlain of the young prince as well.
So these would have been people who were close to young Edward, and were taken, arrested right there. Is that correct? In the morning. Okay. Can you tell us what that might have been like? I mean, imagine all of that going on. Where had they all spent the night? Had Anthony Woodville gone back to be with Edward, young Edward, overnight? Or where was everybody?
Now, as far as we know, Anthony, and like I said, if he was with Richard Grey, they definitely stayed in Northampton. So this is literally, there's some kind of imaginings of literally in their nightclothes being dragged away kind of image, really. Actually, Richard Vaughan was definitely with the prince. So as his chamberlain, so he was his closest servant, really. And actually he'd known him since a child. He'd carried Prince Edward when Louis, Lord of Gruthuse, was invited over after Edward was restored, because the Prince Edward had actually been born whilst Edward was in exile. Once everything was restored, he invited Louis, Lord of Gruthuse, over to say, "Thank you, you saved our lives," basically. So there was a lot of pageantry over that. But actually Thomas Vaughan carried little baby Prince Edward during a lot of that. So it's at this point that I think, gosh, whatever has happened, whether it really is a plot or not, he's still got a 12-year-old boy who's had the people that he's known the most. And actually, they're probably more like father figures to him than his own father was, suddenly ripped from him. I can't help but feel like, gosh, how much that felt for him, because it must have been hard enough to suddenly go, right, you're king now, your dad's just died. And then suddenly you're having the people who are the closest other than your father taken from you. I think that must have been quite hard. You know, it must have been tough to tell a 12-year-old, you're king now, enough as it is. Although obviously he was, or, you know, they would have been seen almost as an adult, not quite, but almost more of an adult than perhaps we'd see a 12-year-old now. But you still think, well, regardless, that's a big situation to suddenly throw somebody into at whatever age, let alone at 12.
Yeah, so much has changed for him. And the thing that's been constant is those few people in his life. So now you're leaving Ludlow, where you've been, your home, where you're really comfortable. You're on your way to London with these people, you know, but now you're on your way not to see your father, the king, but to be the king. So things are already changing so much, and then they're taken away. So what happens to, let's stay with Anthony for a minute, and then we'll go back and rejoin Edward. So what happens to Anthony when he is arrested and prevented from seeing young Edward again?
Okay, so the three men that are arrested, Anthony, Richard Grey and Thomas Vaughan, they are all actually taken to separate places in Richard's heartlands in the north. So they're all placed at various different spots. But Anthony himself was actually imprisoned initially at Sheriff Hutton, which had been, you know, like I said, it was part of Richard's lands. So he would, they were all separated as well, which does suggest that obviously they might not want people talking to them or to them talking to each other, whatever. So I think that must have been probably quite a lonely experience. Very confusing, confusing time, really. So we do know that actually from when they are arrested in April, that actually nothing's done with them yet. They're left where they are, which to me suggests perhaps it might not be quite as emergency as you'd have thought if they're nothing's done straight away, or whether there's some investigating going on. We don't, you know, we can't know that, you know, in this passage of time. But like, so nothing is done immediately. So, you know, it's not like it had been put in a dungeon. So they're still kind of treated like the gentlemen that they were, but, you know, they were still in prison. But we do know that Anthony actually carried on writing whilst in prison. So he actually wrote a final poem that has survived, which is, it's quite complicated, but the whole gist is the idea of the Wheel of Fortune turning always, not necessarily in the way that you might want it to, which is actually quite depressing, because he's pretty much saying in the end, I welcome death. That's probably what's going to happen. And which is, yeah, you know, that obviously must have been in their minds.
Right. Once you're arrested and left behind and you no longer have the king, the young king, you must have been very concerned. You're separated from everybody else. You're on your own. Even if you're still treated like a noble, you're still imprisoned, not in a dungeon, but you still can't just get on your horse and ride away. So yeah. It must have, he's sensing that this is really going badly. So meanwhile, young Edward is taken into London, but not with Antony as planned. Now he and Richard and that group, but now he's with Richard and Buckingham, and they take him into London. So how long does Antony stay in prison before he's executed? And I'm sorry if that was a little spoiler alert for anybody. What is the charge? I mean, how is that then processed? And do we know, does he know what's happening meanwhile in London when he's, you know, communication is just more difficult. He can't pull out his phone and see what's happening on, you know, the news app or whatever. So does he know what's happening? We may not even know that. Do we know that?
Yeah, that's the bit that we don't really know, how much he would have known as to what was, you know, going off in London, you know, whether or not he knew that there were sort of still plans for a coronation at this point. We're not really totally sure, but then we're also not sure. There's some sources that say yes, there's other sources that say no, that whether they had a trial. That's a whole other issue, whether they had one or not, really. Because there's some sources that say yes, they do, and then they argue as to whether who was in charge of this, whether it was the Earl of Northumberland, who was basically the person put in charge of the North after, you know, Richard obviously ended up having to go to London. And then other people say, well, yes, it was, but it might have been William Catesby or Richard Ratcliffe, who were some of other notable men of Richard's. But actually, that would make sense, as you know, they were from a kind of lawyer background. I'm sorry. Suddenly, the giant spider there. Sorry.
Oh dear.
Okay. So there's arguments as to whether or not there was this trial that held for them or not, which obviously would have been the confirming that there was a Woodville plot, basically. So that's kind of, whether they had a trial or not, that's basically what they're charged with, is plotting, basically.
All right. So they're charged with plotting and they're found guilty, or they're just found guilty. If there was a trial, they're charged and found guilty. Otherwise, they are ultimately found guilty. And are they still all separate, or are the three of them brought back together at any point?
Yes, so they actually, all three of them are brought to Pontefract Castle once, you know, there's no getting out of the fact that they're going to be executed.
Okay, all right. So tell us about the execution, and can you give us the date so we kind of get the sense of how quickly this moves.
Yes, so they were arrested in April of 1483, and they are executed on the 25th of June. A good few months. So actually, like I said, at the same point, it's quite quickly, but at the same point, not instant either. So,
right.
Yeah.
So it doesn't seem to be an emergency. Like, oh no, there's some kind of plot going on. Grab them and put them in trial. You know, so there's that. So, what is happening in London while this happens up north at Pontefract? So what is May like in London? What is June like in London? And then just after they're executed, what is July like in London?
So basically, between the arrest and the execution, it's very much, like I said, that suddenly evidence is wheeled out of things like this cart of weapons with Woodville coat of arms on is brought as evidence to London as to why, you know, plots are going off and things like that. And actually, we also have some other members of the Woodville family. So Thomas Marquis of Dorset, who is Edward Elizabeth's oldest son from her first marriage. He's really... I think he's a lot more of a plotter than he put himself for, shall we say. So personally, I think if there was a Woodville plot, it was probably Dorset, because he was not very happy. He really wanted to be in it. You know, when Richard brought the young prince to London, he really wanted to be in on everything, and I don't think he really liked the fact that he probably wasn't, because he was a very similar personality to Edward IV in terms of he'd enjoyed the, you know, all the womanizing and all this, that and the other. And I think obviously everybody guessed that part of Edward's reign was not something that necessarily needed to be repeated in this, in these difficult circumstances. So he's very much like throwing his toys out of the pram, going, well, why aren't I being involved in and things like that? And you also have... possibly Edward Woodville, who is Anthony's youngest brother, possibly running away with the treasury as well. So I think very much that there's other Woodvilles who might have possibly been showing their signs as to who might have been involved in any possible plot, really. So all that's going off, really, as well as, like I said, there is still at that particular point aims to make, preparations for the coronation of the young king, which sadly doesn't end up going to fruition.
Right. So when young Edward originally comes to London and is put in the Tower, initially that is not at all a frightening, oh no, thing, because the monarch would typically spend time in the Tower before the coronation.
Yes, that's right.
So that's not yet, but as time goes on and the coronation is postponed and things are starting to change. Okay, so when does Elizabeth Woodville, who is in sanctuary at this time, find out about the executions and what's happened to her brother? Do we know when she finds out?
Now, this is the thing that I found the most surprising. Actually, because we all get the image that Anthony was probably Elizabeth's favourite sibling, and yet we don't have any evidence of what her feelings was at the fact that her brother and her son have just been executed one after the other, as well as obviously Thomas Vaughan. So we don't actually know how she found out, what she'd have felt like necessarily, or whether or not she was in a possible situation to kind of intervene for them in any way. This is the bit that I found quite difficult to get my head around, that there's no kind of explanation as to what she necessarily would have felt like, which we kind of do before when, so her father and her brother, Richard and John Woodville, had been executed without trial on the orders of Warwick at the Battle of Edgecote. earlier on, and we kind of get the feeling that that really affects the family, but there doesn't seem to be much as to whether these particular executions did necessarily. So that's the bit that I've found quite hard to get my head around, because the only thing that we know post-execution is, because we don't even know 100% what happened to their bodies either, so it's all completely mysterious, really. But there is actually evidence in Richard Duke of Gloucester's accounts that he actually did pay for burial for Richard Grey. And we do know that possibly Thomas Vaughan, he has at least got a memorial in Westminster Abbey. As to whether that means his body's there is another matter. I mean, it's entirely possible if burial's been paid for Richard Grey. So there's not even a case of, any explanation for what happened afterwards either.
So this is really interesting because, of course, this moment is very, very bad for the Woodvilles. Elizabeth is in sanctuary. The brothers, as you say, fleeing or being accused, or this one's executed, so things are bad. And it does turn out that Richard ends up on the throne. I mean, that's the spoiler alert for everybody, right? So Richard takes the throne. And, Elizabeth spends quite a bit more time in sanctuary. We don't know what happened to the two princes. We won't go there. And later, if we fast forward, Elizabeth of York does participate in the next regime after Richard. But Antony, let's go back to Antony. That's where we started. And that's, of course, what this book is. And you mentioned that it's very mysterious because it's almost like he just disappears.
Yeah.
So you mentioned at the beginning that your hope was you went to Pontefract. It's so important. This is such an important story. And yet they don't really know. When you ask the guides, they can't really tell his story there. They don't really tell his story there. So you're telling his story. So if we end up with this, we're not really sure what happened. We're not really sure where he was buried. We're not sure how Elizabeth felt about him, who would seem to be her favorite sibling, maybe, and certainly the one who was taking care of her son, the heir, for all that time. How can you sort of bring us to what you want us to remember about him, since his end sort of just disappears? What should we take away from this story about someone who in some cases is lost in some ways to history?
Yeah, so I think for me, the easiest way to explain who he was, I've seen quite a few historians explain that Edward IV wanted to create his idea of a new Camelot, which I think is quite a fitting kind of metaphor, really, that he was very much, he wanted to be King Arthur, and this legendary king. So I think somebody asked me about this before, and I said, to me, Antony is actually his version of Merlin. As in, he's the guy probably doing a lot more of the backseat stuff. It's actually really quite important, but you don't really know what he's doing behind the scenes. But actually, it doesn't mean that it's not important. So, for example, actually, this whole period of time is very much seen as, ideas of chivalry and everything are kind of coming back to the fore again, which is quite sad because now we just see it as it was probably the last days of chivalry. But they didn't know that. They just wanted to, reignite the ideas, because it was worried that a lot of the ideas of chivalry had kind of been lost a bit, really, obviously, understandably, with a lot of these, infighting and this, that and the other. So that's kind of what I see Antony has, in terms of, yes, perhaps he's doing the stuff behind the scenes, but actually it's the really quite important stuff that's actually, it makes what we think of the culture of the Wars of the Roses, isn't really, that Antony's actually quite at the fore of this, even though he doesn't look like he is.
I think that's a great way to think about it, because the person in the background often is the one who makes possible what happens sort of in the stage or in the front or that we see. So he was working to create and help bring up this new king who could carry on that dynasty and carry on the plans that Edward IV, you know, who should have taken better care of himself so it could have lasted, yeah, right?
Exactly. It's really all his fault.
Part of the problem. I mean, if he'd done a little better job of taking care of himself.
Yeah.
But he had this vision, and his son was the fulfillment of that vision. And Anthony Woodville was the one he was trusting to prepare the son to sort of step in yeah. and take that into the future. And so I really appreciate you're telling us the story of Anthony Woodville, because he often does get lost. And the way his story ends, with it sort of just almost fading away into the dark, you know, is unfortunately what has happened. And so I really appreciate you bringing it out, and cannot wait for the book to appear on my Kindle. So tell us again when it's coming out and when we can look for it.
Yeah, so publication date is the 15th of February, so not that long
away. Not that long,
I've just noticed, yes. Yeah, so that's UK. And I've noticed, as you've said, Carol, that it's actually available for pre-order at the moment, but in America, but it's only for the Kindle version at the moment.
Right, right. Yeah, I should have mentioned that. I pre-ordered the Kindle because that's what's available now. And do you have a U.S. date for the hard? I always like to get both. So
yeah.
You have a U.S. date for the hardcover as well?
No, I haven't been given one at the moment. So at the moment, it's just a Kindle that's available for pre-order, as far as I know, for America.
Okay, all right. Well, we'll keep checking and fill that in. So as we are waiting for that and moving forward, where can we find you? What social media, and what are you working on now? What's in the future?
Okay, so yep, you can find me on, I still call it Twitter. Well, you know, everybody knows it's X now. Yeah, so I'm Princess Burton on that. I'm also on Instagram under Voyager of History, which is actually my blog title. So you can also find me on that, which is www.voyagerofhistory.wordpress.com. And I'm also on Facebook as well, which is also under Danielle Burton as well.
All right. And I'll have all these links in the show notes. So that's great.
Yeah.
And what's to come? What are you working on now?
Okay. So yeah, as I said, I'm mainly a history blogger. So for that, how I describe it is I concentrate on lesser known stories, i.e. sort of Anthony Woodville, but from lots of different time periods, really, which is roughly from kind of the 15th century up until late 19th, early 20th, roughly. We'll go with that. Okay. So there's lots of blog posts sorted. So I think the next one that I'm hoping to do as a proper blog post, I want to look into Charles Dickens and a train crash he was involved in, which not a lot of people necessarily know, and that slightly put him off trains afterwards.
Well, that's wonderful. And some of these lesser known stories we find out are so important to
Definitely.
Really grasp how these things happen. How does this turn out this way? And it's the lesser known stories that really make this happen.
That's actually what I've been working on. So I also do quite a few history talks based on things that I've done research wise. And actually the one that I'm doing later at the end of February is actually on a woman called Margaret Cavendish, who is Duchess of Newcastle. That she's been a bit of a history hero of mine since I volunteered for at my local English Heritage Site at Bolsover Castle. And I've just pretty much loved her since then, to be honest, because actually she was a very modern woman, considering she was living in 1600s. So she was actually very interested in science. She used microscopes. She wrote about over 20 different things in her life. As well. So I've been, so that's my next talk that I'm doing, is explaining why. So she's been named Mad Madge because of all of the exciting things that she did. And but as it turns out, I've just found out that it was actually only the Victorians that called her that. So
those Victorians. Well, that's wonderful. Yeah. So we'll have, if you can send me that, we'll have that, a link to that too in the show notes.
Yeah.
So just let people know. Well, Thank you so much. This has been such a treat to learn about somebody
Great,
we didn't know very well, don't know a lot about, but now we really can see all those pieces of that time Good. Period all fit together. So thank you so much. Thank you, everyone, for joining us. It's been a treat. I'll have all the information. We're counting down the days till your book. And we'll all continue here to learn about lesser-known stories like you say and all other kinds of royals, rebels, and romantics in history. So thanks so much, everybody. Thank you for joining me for this episode of Royals, Rebels, and Romantics. I really appreciate your spending some time with us. If you would subscribe wherever you are on listening or on YouTube, leave a rating and maybe share with a friend. And please plan to join us next time as we keep shaking up history together.